The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place, so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month, so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, and I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Thank you, as always, to our listeners who are listening on Tuesday. Those subscribers are helping to keep this thing sustainable. As a reminder, we're always here if you need help setting up your private RSS feed on Substack. The way it works, you know, you sign up for Substack, they give you a private RSS feed. It sends you the ad-free thing. You plug it right into Apple or Spotify or whatever. It works great. You can leave a comment here. You can shoot us an email at acrossthemovieaisle@gmail.com. If you're listening on Substack, but you're not a paying subscriber and you prefer to receive this via RSS, you can always subscribe at Apple, Spotify, other fine podcast purveyors. It will have the ads, etc. But you know, whatever. You can also leave us reviews over there, I guess. I think that's still helpful. We're trying to expand our global domination all over. And now on to controversies and non-controversies. 2025. It's a controversial year. Or maybe 2026 will be controversial. I don't know. It's kind of a slow week, as always, this last week of the year. So we're going to just look back or look ahead and think about what the biggest stories of the year are or were or whatever. Peter, what do you got for us?
It's just that everything's YouTube now. I mean, Derek Thompson did a pretty good piece that was like everything's television, but I actually think this is only sort of correct with respect to Derek Thompson. It was a really interesting piece. It's actually that everything is YouTube. And like even more, like in some ways, obviously the biggest sort of story in our world was the Netflix-Warner Brothers merger. But I view the Netflix-Warner Brothers merger in many ways as a kind of counterweight to the rising dominance of YouTube. And I mean, there's a story in the FT just a couple of days ago. The creator economy advertising market is expected to reach $37 billion this year, up 26% from a year ago, right? Like that is a gigantic increase. It's expected to increase another 18% in 2026, right? And so that's just the creator economy advertising market. That's not all of YouTube. That's not right. That's just the kind of the ads that go into all of this. And I just think if you are interested in Hollywood, in filmed entertainment of any kind right now, you have to be looking at YouTube as this sort of this megalith, right? Like it's like an object in a Denis Villeneuve movie, right? It's so big that where you just sort of have to take it in for a moment, and there's a giant blob, and it's just like, oh, YouTube. Everything is YouTube. That's the big story, right? Like, and everything is downstream from that. That's the Warner Brothers Netflix merger. They're getting bigger so that they can compete with YouTube, which is the, like, as I've argued previously on this podcast, the alternative model. That's also the little stuff, like all of the scripted shows that are going to YouTube as what are being called sort of verticals or shorts or whatever, these kind of tiny little episodic, basically soap operas. Right now, they're mostly aimed at women, although there is a huge push, I think, in the next year, we're going to see to move out into sort of male genre stuff where you're going to see crime and action and science fiction, right?
Like the vindication of Quibi.
Right. People are going to take advantage of this and sort of look, if everything is on YouTube and it's all pretty cheap, right? And in fact, a sort of cheap, fast, just get it online, make it work model is the way to make money right now, then we are going to see, I think, an explosion of kind of cheap, pulpy, probably in most cases, trashy, but hopefully in a few cases, interesting, scripted, pulpy material that is going to sort of harken back to the heyday of like short story magazines in the 20s and 30s, when there was a huge amount of just kind of total trash short story pulp, except now in retrospect, a lot of it looks better. And also, there were some classics that came out of that, especially in the kind of science fiction and Western genres. And I think we're going to see more of that stuff on YouTube. I'm hopeful that we will see that there will be some diamonds in the rough there.
Yeah, interesting.
Alyssa, what was your biggest story of the year or like thing you're looking forward to in the year to come?
So I know that Peter is concerned about sort of the YouTube versus everything else, but I remain, you know, interested to see what happens with the Warner Brothers acquisition. I mean, sort of the latest as we are taping this, with the caveat that could change at any time, is that Larry Ellison has personally guaranteed, I think, $44 billion of Paramount's proposed purchase price for the takeover of Warner Brothers, including CNN. And that was considered sort of the sticking point, or at least that's what Warner Brothers was telling shareholders the sticking point was with Paramount's offer. You know, look, maybe this is all just deck chairs on the Titanic. These are the sort of the last throes of a dying industry, or at least the last throes of an industry that's transitioning from being mass entertainment into being, you know, what opera is today. But I continue to think that a massive business realignment in, you know, one of the country's most important cultural industries, and one that has drawn the attention of the president in ways that are potentially sort of really politically ugly, and combine that with a potentially really rapid political makeover in, you know, large sectors of our news and entertainment production, that remains really consequential. And I think we don't know for sure what's going to happen yet with Warner Brothers, with CNN. And I just can't imagine that won't be hugely important in the coming year.
Yeah. And like on top of everything else, this is kind of the mega story in a lot of ways, because it doesn't just touch on TV and streaming and film. It doesn't just touch on production and distribution, right? It goes beyond that. It really gets into a lot of awkward and ugly questions about government interference in business and political favoritism and that sort of thing. And I tend to agree with you that this is not what I picked, because I figured one of us would pick it, and I wanted to go a different way. But I do think this is probably the biggest story of the year that is wrapping up right now, 2025, and the year to come, 2026, because there is so much to watch here. And I think it is potentially very consequential beyond the world of entertainment, beyond the kind of entertainment industrial complex that we watch on a regular basis here.
We'll see more about that, because like, from either of you, like the consequences beyond the world of entertainment.
Sure. So my big reading project for 2025 turned out to be a lot of military histories of World War II. And I'm finishing up Ian Toll's trilogy on the war in the Pacific. And I promise this is all getting to the point. But part of what's really fascinating about sort of his and John Tolan's writing about Japan in the run up to World War II is that you had a scenario where some of the major newspapers in Japan used sort of a sense that that they basically used a willingness to conform politically to gain market share in Japan, you know, whether by getting smaller organs sort of censored or by using kind of fidelity to the regime as like a marketing tactic. And, you know, that had enormous consequences for shaping the Japanese public's sort of media diet and understanding of what was going on in the world at large. And so, yeah, I think that if you have a scenario where, you know, CBS and CNN are taken over, where, you know, the sort of owner's politics are used to, you know, if the owner's politics become a tool to sort of further acquisitions and growth, that can end up very consequential for an overall media environment. I mean, look, the United States is a much more sort of, you know, fractious media environment in some ways than, you know, than would have been possible in the pre-internet era. You know, international news is more freely available. But just reading about an era in both sort of Japanese media and frankly in US media, where, you know, information was more tightly circumscribed, where politics became a tool of, you know, sort of business strategy with sort of big consequences for the information ecosystem. You know, I think anytime that you're looking at potential, that cycle, it has the opportunity to shape the environment in really radical ways. And we can't know what the downstream consequences of those are.
So obviously, totally agree. And I'm like very concerned about all of this. I've said so on the podcast. But as I have been considering this, I would actually just go back to my answer about everything being YouTube. The counterweight to control of a network news operation, you know, an ancient broadcast network news operation, and even cable news, is that you can start your own media company now for $10 on YouTube. I mean, not for $10, but like, you know, 100%. And there are times when we are seeing some of these things pop up that they don't exist. And 6 months later, they're massively influential, or at least like amongst a sort of certain cohort. And 2 years later, they have huge, huge reach, especially with younger people. And that is one thing that we forget, is that all of these sort of legacy media outlets, if you're under 45, unless you work in media or sort of a particular kind of elite space, that's not where you're getting your news. It's just
But at the same time, Peter, you know, I think that is both true and underestimates the extent to which so much of this is algorithmically dependent and thus vulnerable, right? I mean, you know, if, and as we saw during the COVID pandemic in the Biden administration, you know, these companies can be pressured to, you know, delist or, you know, sort of de-emphasize speech that people in government don't like. And so, you know, these are not like zines that are being run as samizdat and are, you know, just are where the production and distribution are actually really independent of some of these big, you know, these big political and business pressures. I mean, look, you know, a sale of the U.S. operations of TikTok are going through. Like, what happens if, you know, Trump decides that he, you know, or a subsequent administration, you know, wants some tweaks to the algorithms at YouTube, and YouTube is in some sort of position where that is advantageous to them. You know, I think that the source of resiliency and vulnerability are the same, and that's a really tricky situation.
Yeah. And just beyond that, there's the whole like, well, you know, we don't want to do this thing if it's going to, you know, run into regulatory. It is so mob-like. It is so like, it's a nice little business you got there. Hate to see something happen to it in the regulatory process, that it just kind of messes everything up. And like I said, that goes beyond like any individual content decision. It deforms the entirety of the economy.
Well, it goes beyond Hollywood and entertainment. I mean, the cover story in Reason Magazine, and I'm sorry, but the cover story in Reason Magazine right now is Republican socialism. And it's about Trump explicitly taking stakes, using the government to take stakes in, we're now up to something like a dozen companies. I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, right? And even where the Trump administration is not taking explicit stakes, it is involving itself in these mega deals. And it's very worrying. I think, have a little more faith, a little more trust in kind of market and competitive alternatives here. Like the thing is, never expect there to be, like, my worldview is, these things are not a steady state. Like, even if we have a scenario like we had during COVID, where the Biden administration was working with Facebook in ways that I thought that courts should have ruled illegal. I thought the courts ruled wrong when they ruled on this, but they were clearly working with Facebook to take down posts. A lot of stuff that I disagreed with, actually, but like in a way that was jawboning that was just not appropriate for an administration. Even if we have that kind of situation with YouTube, there's always the next thing. Because if we were having this conversation 15 years ago, YouTube as a meaningful competitor to CNN, Warner Brothers, and even Netflix at the time would have seemed absolutely absurd.
Yeah, but I like this is kind of talking past each other because I agree with you in theory that there are more options than ever before and you know more ways to circumvent et cetera but that's not specifically the thing I'm worried about. I'm more concerned with the kind of mucking about with the very process of forming a business or slightly different thing.
I guess I am also concerned, and I'm just trying to find some way to think beyond this or have hope or like not just sort of sit here and be like, this is real bad. It's real bad. It is. But it's real bad. And that's not the end of the story.
Yeah.
It's real bad. And we can't let it be the end of the story.
Well, it's real bad. And there's not a whole lot we can do about it. So, the thing I would focus on, and again, I do think the Warner Brothers / Paramount / Netflix story here is the biggest kind of story of the year. But there is another kind of element of government interference and everything that I think is that was like an underappreciated story last year. I think it was underappreciated because nobody could really make heads or tails of it. But when Donald Trump threatened to put 100% tariffs on foreign films was an insane thing. It was an insane thing. And the responses to this are all very hypothetical because nobody has any idea really what those tariffs would look like or how they would circumvent being just a straightforward tax. Like you could tax foreign subsidies at 100%. I don't think anybody disagrees you could do that. That would just require an act of Congress. And this was the least busy year in terms of numbers. I saw a story about this just today when we were right before we recorded that this was the least number of passed bills signed by the president of I don't know some period of time. And so you know there's not a whole lot getting done. He can't just if he can't just push the tariff button, nothing happens. He said it twice now, right? He suggested it in May, 100% tariffs, and then in September he was again like 100% tariffs on foreign films. Again, nobody has any idea what this looks like. It is potentially an enormous deal. Set aside again the impact this would have on the film industry, higher ticket prices domestically, foreign market restrictions overseas, et cetera. And instead, just consider that it could, I don't know, ignite a trade war that would destroy the entire information economy, like from everything from software to Amazon Web Services. The way that this would have to be done, which again, you'd basically be importing a thing that is beamed over the internet back to studios. It just doesn't make any sense. The other potential outcome here, right, is the creation. Again, you would have to do this through legislation. Of a federal filming credit, which
that's what you think, Sonny.
Well, I assume that's how laws are still. I've seen Schoolhouse Rock. I don't know.
I live in Washington, D.C., and let me tell you.
but a federal filming credit, you know, that would compete with those provided by England or Saudi Arabia or whatever and would stack on top of similar credits and that are offered by states like New York or Georgia to make filming in America more competitive. This is a preferable outcome to a tariff, I think, even if I don't think I'm not a big fan of this sort of thing just in general. I don't love it. But I do think that there is an unfair marketplace out there. The other countries really are screwing with the market on this. So it's maybe it's a good idea. I don't know.
All movies should star AI resurrections of John Wayne and be shot in Texas.
I don't know about that. You would have to. That's a whole different.
It's going to be really funny when Rush Hour 4 is shot in like Saudi Arabia or Durkistan. And Brett Ratner is going to be like, it's because of the tax credit, guys. It's the only way we could get this funded.
The female lead is Tilly Norwood.
Yeah. It's all great.
No, the big story, and I, this is going to be a story headed into next year, because I can't imagine at some point Donald Trump does not yet again reiterate his preference for 100% tariffs on foreign films, but we'll see what happens. The other big story heading into 2026, as Peter mentioned, is kind of the YouTubeification of everything. One thing I've been kind of fascinated by is how some of the other companies are responding to this. So one way is you have a bunch of free ad-supported streaming channels, right? You've got your Tubis and whatever, which are basically designed to be like, hey, look, we're YouTube, but with real movies, and we're free, and you should watch us. You should watch us there. Which is kind of interesting. And then there's Netflix, which has basically poached is the wrong word, because YouTube wasn't paying these people except in advertising revenue. But YouTube or Netflix has spent a ton of money. I don't even know how. I don't think anybody has said how much, bringing podcasts to their site starting next year. Right. So you're going to have like Ringer shows like The Rewatchables and the Bill Simmons podcast. You're going to have Barstool Sports. Some iHeartMedia shows are going to be. They're going to have their video podcasts hosted on Netflix. And I actually have more mixed feelings about the evolution of podcasting from an audio to a visual medium. It's bullshit, but it's, you know, whatever.
Here we are. Fine. You can watch us, guys, on the internet.
I'm happy to see folks getting paid for what they do. That's good. Podcasters getting paid is great. People should pay all the podcasters. But I don't think this really solves the YouTube problem at all. Which, because they're not really paying for the content here. Netflix is going to be paying for the content. And like, it's not like this hurts YouTube in any real way. It's not like they're losing a huge chunk of the audience here.
The speculation I've seen on Netflix bringing on podcasts is that, they like to try stuff. Why not? Podcasts are getting bigger. But mostly, it's a maneuver to make the relevant market look larger when the antitrust review comes in, so that they can say, we're not just competing against, the other studios. We're competing in this much wider world that includes YouTube, which is now basically the biggest podcast platform, but also like Spotify, right? And so that they can make a cleaner argument that the relevant market is larger. I think the relevant market is, in fact, that large with or without the podcasts, but that is actually for them a pretty small amount of spend so that they can make the argument to regulators.
I think that's a safe, that's probably, I mean, look, I assume they're not spending $2 billion a year on these podcasts. It's probably not that much money, but it's still...
I don't think that's the only thing that is happening here, but I don't think they're unhappy that this makes their legal argument easier.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see. Who knows what will happen? Maybe a nuclear bomb will go off, and then we can talk about that. It'll be great.
Make sure you show me on Substack.com
on Thursday for our bonus episode on Hamnet. We're going to be talking about one of the award season frontrunners. Is it likely to end up on our best of list? Well, you've already seen mine probably, so no. But maybe the other guys, I don't know. You'll have to listen to find out. And now on to the main event.
Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Marty Supreme. Before we get to Marty Supreme, though, I want to highlight a very weird thing that happened this year. So Josh and Benny Safdie, after many years of making films together, decided to take a break and to make separate movies. They both wound up making period piece sports movies for A24. About outsider sports, weirdo outsider sports, both of which feature one-on-one competitors engaged in tournament competitions that culminate in a big bout or fight or game in Japan. It's bizarre. I don't have a grand theory here. I don't have a grand theory here. I just want to be very clear. I don't have like some sort of psychological reading of this, except to say that comparing Benny Safdie's The Smashing Machine to Josh Safdie's Marty Supreme gives us a clue as to who has the filmmaking juice in that partnership, because everything The Smashing Machine kind of whiffed on, issues of pacing, it's got this kind of lockdown stage. It's boring. It's a boring movie in many ways. I liked it more than you guys did, I think, but it was a boring movie in certain regards. Marty Supreme corrects all that. It's just a much better, much better done version of a very similar thing. The setup is both like very straightforward in Marty Supreme and outwardly deceptive. Marty Mauser, who is played by Timothy Chalamet, is a very good ping pong player. He's good at ping pong, loves ping pong, number one in the United States, I guess. And he hopes to win the world championship, which is being played in England when the film starts and then is played in Japan at the end of the film a year later. The film is nominally about his desire to win this championship. In reality, Marty Supreme is about the various scams and silliness that he has to undertake to afford his trips to these tournaments. From an armed robbery of sorts in the beginning to a madcap trip through New York and its environs that includes, at various points, a ping pong hustle, a kidnapped dog, and his attempt to steal jewelry from an actress. Marty is just trying to make a buck, man. He's just trying, not even to make a buck. He's just trying to make the money to get on the plane to go on this trip. Marty Mauser is a charming scumbag. In other words, he's just objectively a bad person. He's a bad person. This is a bad person, a movie about a bad person, but one with a force of personality that demands to be paid attention to. It's very much feels like the role Chalamet was born to play, a perfect mix of his public movie star persona and actually charm. Unlike The Smashing Machine, starring Dwayne Johnson, this is a movie that feels like it's from the team that made Uncut Gems. It is often stressful. It is often frustrating. It is always compellingly watchable. In all seriousness, at some point towards the end of the film's second hour, I was like, wait, have we really spent all of this time on a scam involving a gangster and a dog? And sure enough, we did. And I didn't care. I did not care. It helps that the cast is just fantastic from top to bottom. You have plenty of traditional actors like Gwyneth Paltrow, Fran Drescher, of course, Timothy Chalamet. Newer names like Odessa Azian, who I think is just really great as Marty's friend slash lover slash partner in crime. But the movie really shines because of the incredible number of non-actors turning in brilliant performances. You've got Kevin O'Leary from Shark Tank, who is earning all the plaudits in this, playing a kind of rapacious capitalist who is just out trying to, control the world. There are all sorts of odd names here, though. Directors Abel Ferreira and David Mamet both have parts. Abel Ferreira plays the aforementioned gangster, and he's just really terrifying in that role. Magician Penn Jillette shows up in a small bit. Isaac Mizrahi is in there somewhere. A guy named Mitchell Wenig with crazy hair, who people will remember from Uncut Gems. Remember the Uncut Gems guy? He's back. He's back as Abel Ferreira's manservant in this. I'm honestly kind of curious what general audiences will make of this movie. It's gotten a B+ from CinemaScore audiences, which is very surprising to me, because it is a very weirdly structured movie. It's very much about a person who is unlikable, and audiences tend not to like unlikable protagonists. But I loved it. I almost feel bludgeoned into loving it. I was just like, this is really happening. All this is happening, huh? It's riveting and it's captivating from start to finish. Alyssa, what did you make of Marty Supreme?
So I saw Marty Supreme last night, and I think I'm still sitting with it a little bit. But my initial reaction is also that I loved it. And when we were texting about this before the episode, Peter said that this is a really interesting sort of A or B side to The Brutalist, and that it is also a story about being, in part, about being Jewish in post-World War II America. But in this case, it is about an American Jew, someone who was young enough not to have fought in World War II. He's 23. The movie, I think, is set in 1952. And it is more subtle in some ways about its treatment of American Jewishness. But a very interesting sort of through line is sort of the contest between Marty and Rockwell, the Kevin O'Leary character, who is a pen magnate. And it is a, you know, there are many things happening in that relationship. But it's sort of inciting moment is a scene where Rockwell notices that Marty is eating with someone who's a Holocaust survivor. He has, numbers tattooed on his arm. And the Rockwell character says, you know, my son died liberating you. And it's this fascinating moment of like sort of doubly stolen valor because his son died. Like, yes, his son, he's talking about his son, not himself, but his son died in the Pacific, right? And so it is this fascinating moment of, you know, an Anglo-American trying to sort of see literally take advantage of the moral high ground that came from America's role in liberating Holocaust survivors. And again, if you know, I talked earlier in the episode about spending a lot of this year reading World War II history, but, you know, part of what is so fascinating about the American campaign in Europe is that, you know, the Americans did not know about the concentration camps beforehand, right? I mean, they knew, you know, and I should say clearly, like American soldiery writ large did not know, you know, what was happening in the death camps. Like George Patton, the general who's sort of the famous American kind of fighting general in Europe, is so distressed the first time he encounters a concentration camp that he throws up in front of his men. And so, you know, the moral authority of World War II was really something that arrived towards the end of the war and in hindsight. And that scene is sort of a fascinating reflection of that. And this relationship culminates in a sequence where Marty is participating in a stage match and the loser has to kiss a pig. And it is the only scene in the movie where I think you actually see a Star of David necklace that he's wearing around his neck. And he basically does whatever he can to avoid that particular humiliation, right? There's something so specific about this, you know, and the stage match is he's doing it for money from Rockwell. And so this person who stole this valor about the Holocaust is, you know, attempting to violate on some level, you know, I mean, kissing a pig obviously isn't exactly the same thing as eating pork, but like is attempting to visit this ritual taboo on, you know, on a young American Jew. And it's a fascinating sort of arc within the movie because, you know, Marty sort of uses his wits to get out of it. And, you know, The Brutalist is very much a story of, you know, sort of the inability to shake the tragedy of the Holocaust. Whereas Marty Supreme is a movie about the, you know, the Jewish response to the Holocaust. The sort of the dual responses of sort of hustle and humor, right? You know, there's this sense that, you know, you have to charm your way into survival. And so I found that sort of that like structural arc in the movie really fascinating. And, you know, There's a lot of the gangster and the dog. There's a lot of just like how many things can possibly go wrong in this guy's life. I mean, I think there is a sort of, there is an artificiality to the sheer number of mishaps.
Can I jump in here just for one second?
Sure.
Did you say how many things can go wrong in his life? And I think that this confers an element of non-agency on Mark yes. Supreme. How many things can he fuck up in his life is yes. I think a yes. more specific, because he gets away with things, and then he still, for instance, there's a sequence in which he is given a very nice piece of jewelry by this actress who he is trying to woo, and then tries to have sex with her in public, and the cops catch them and take the necklace as a bribe.
Yes.
And like that's yeah. entirely on him. That's a him problem, and all of his problems are him problems.
Would the fantasy $100 that he needs is because he stayed in the Ritz Hotel when he wasn't supposed to and maybe trashed it or something. It's sort of unclear there. The
ball
ring sequence that is kind of the inciting incident for Act Two and the whole dog situation is he was told not to go in the stupid shower. And he then immediately goes and sits in the bath, fills the bathtub up with water. And of course, it crashes through the floor. And like, again, it's always his fault, and he's like,
yes,
he's like the roadrunner, right? Like, just sort of like the this movie is like a, it's not quite as Looney Tunes as say John Wick in the sense that it's not built around gags, but it is just like watching this character. You want to see how far they can keep running when they have long ago left that cliff.
Well, and the movie is constantly testing this question of just like how much of a fuck up asshole can you be and still be sort of innately appealing. There's a scene, you know, Sonny, you mentioned the scene in the movie where, you know, he gets this necklace, they lose it to the police in an effort to avoid being arrested. And then he turns to the actress and said, could you get me another necklace? And the theater I was in, everybody lost it at that scene. Because, and the thing is, she's like, she agrees to try, right? And, you know, the movie...
Only after he pressures her, though. She's like, no, that's, no, I'm not gonna, and then eventually she's like, fine. Because he won't take no for an answer. He wants to keep the trouble going.
Yeah. And like, to a certain extent, maybe there's like a little artificiality in the fact that sort of people like that he slips through. Right. I mean, there's like, it feels like there's a little bit of a finger on the scale. But, you know, goddamn, if Chalamet doesn't earn it. Like that guy is working both for his money and for the sort of the utter charm of Marty Mauser. And there are sort of breaking points, right? I mean, one of my favorite just images in the movie where he has been, you know, there's this father and son business duo where the son is sort of, you know, hapless and is kind of convinced that like Marty's maybe a business opportunity. And he's had all of these specialty ping pong balls made up in orange to Marty's specifications. And this guy has just been pushed. And he finally just throws the entire case of ping pong balls out of an apartment window. And it's just spectacular shower of orange against the night. I mean, it's so beautiful and funny. And so, yeah, I mean, they're definitely like, you know, Marty has burned a lot of bridges. We don't necessarily see all of those bridges, like him attempt to reford all those river crossings to sort of torture this metaphor a little bit. But yeah, I don't, you know, we're going to talk... in the bonus about Hamnet, a movie that I think is like really hamstrung by one of its lead performances. But this is a movie where I just really struggle to figure out another actor who could pull off this combination of, you know, just like roguish and irritating and disreputable and also just like totally compelling, right? I mean, Josh O'Connor is just a, you know, different kind of actor.
Well, this is a classic Leonardo DiCaprio role. This is Leo. Yeah. This is Leo in Wolf of Wall Street or Catch Me If You Can.
It's very Catch Me If You Can.
One last thing, Alyssa, before I jump over to you, Peter, you mentioned the Jewishness of Marty and that element of post-war society was very interesting to me. In part, I think you could make the case that he is kind of an anti-Semitic stereotype in certain regards, right? He is the striving, scammy huckster, like always out for a buck. Like, I compared him to Sammy Glick in my review. Have you ever read What Makes Sammy Run, Alyssa? And I, there, you know, that's a book that was written by Bud Schulberg, who was a Jewish writer, and he was very flummoxed when he got complaints about Sammy being, people perceived him as an anti-Semitic trope. He's like, well, how can he be anti-Semitic? I'm Jewish, you know. That's not, but they're very similar characters in the sense, in the specific sense that they are constantly using other people in ways that are damaging to those people to advance their own ends. Constantly. That is the defining characteristic of Marty Mauser, I think. And I do think that it's interesting. It's an interesting little wrinkle here.
Well, and that question of, you know, what can Jews say about other Jews, about the Holocaust, that Gentiles can't is, in fact, in the text of the movie, right? There's this very funny scene at the sort of British Tables Tennis Championships where Marty is sweet-talking a couple of reporters, and he says that he's going to do to one of his opponents, who is actually, as it turns out, someone who's a friend of his. He's like, I'm going to finish what Auschwitz couldn't. And the reporters are just like, they're taken away. He's like, I can say it, I'm Jewish, right? And so, you know, I think that question of like, I can say it, is very much sort of in the text of the movie. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, there's also, do you guys know the phrase like that something's a shanda for the goyim?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it means that like, Peter, do you know that phrase? It basically means that it's a way of telling, like a Jew telling another Jew that you are sort of shaming Jews collectively in front of the Gentiles. Like the shanda is the shame, the goyim are the Gentiles. And so, you know, that question of like whether, you know, whether something is only appropriate as like kind of an intra-Jewish conversation, whether certain behavior is only appropriate like in front of other, you know, in front of other Jews versus the question of like, you know, can you behave this way like in the wider world, right? Is there like a sort of a special vulnerability there? And, you know, that I think the movie is, if not always sort of explicitly exploring that question, like playing with it a little bit, right? And then, you know, playing with some ideas about patriotism, right? I mean, you know, Marty says to Rockwell at some point that he, you know, thinks it's kind of ugly that Rockwell is trying to make inroads in the Japanese market when his son was killed fighting the Japanese in the Pacific. And it's an interesting, I mean, there's something very fascinating about a ping pong movie, a movie that's about ping pong, that, you know, sort of uses the Holocaust like kind of obliquely, right? Like the question of, you know, sort of, you know, American competition with Japan is kind of this, you know, in-between proxy for a conversation about the aftermath of the Holocaust, right? There's that, like, there is that sort of sense of deflection and bounce to the movie. And it's just, it's really structurally fascinating and controlled in a way that is sort of fascinatingly at odds with the chaos of the characters themselves.
Yeah.
And Peter, what did you make of Marty Supreme?
I mean, just to sort of start where Alyssa left off, the sort of the arc of the movie's sort of discussion of the Jewish experience in America post-World War II is anchored in one of the few truly earnest and kind of harrowing, not kind of, extremely harrowing moments in the film that is not like kind of offset by any kind of humor or modernity or Marty's charm or anything. It's when he's talking to the guy who turned out to be a Holocaust, or talking about the guy who turned out to be a Holocaust survivor, and telling the story of how, of a way that he survived in Auschwitz, which was that he was out in the fields and he found honey like a honeycomb that bees had shoot off the bees, smeared his whole body in the honey, and then brought it back under his shirt so that the other prisoners could lick it off of his chest. And that, like, so much in this movie is played for a kind of comedy, right? Or for a sort of like ridiculous laugh, you know, like, can you believe? And this is a moment of sort of extremity, right? An extreme kind of bizarre, in some ways, behavior. But you're supposed to understand that all of this is grounded in something, in an experience that's really hard to even imagine or think about. And so
it's also a story. But it's also, that is also a story of sort of wiliness and creativity, right? Yes. I mean, you know, that character, and to a certain extent, collaboration, right? The reason this character survived and was in a position to do this is because he was, you know, he had been put to work defusing bombs to keep Nazi soldiers safe, right? Like, he had this skill set that could be reemployed by the regime. And, you know, these are all stories of this question of sort of what do you do to survive is really deeply threaded through the movie. And there's the question of what you do to survive physically, but also sort of what you do to survive, you know, morally, what you do to survive with like dignity as a man, right? And Marty is a character who, for much of the movie, behaves with like absolute lack of dignity. And then, you know, comes to discover this sort of deep need for it in himself at this moment of humiliation that's rooted in a violation of Jewish taboo, even though we don't see him as particularly observant at any other point in the movie.
So since Alyssa mentioned the glorious images in this movie and singled out the scene with the orange ping pong balls crashing out of what the fourth floor apartment in New York, that scene is so great, not just because it's beautiful, but because it is structurally, it is almost exactly three quarters of the way through the movie. It is the scene that explicitly ends like the formal, the main part of the second act. And then what is the next thing you see is you see Marty and his sort of girlfriend in the hallway. They're having this quiet conversation. Now we are in the dark night of the soul. That is the shadow of death. That is the moment when all of his dreams are literally tossed out the window in this kind of beautiful showering of orange ping pong balls just bouncing through the Lower East Side. And it is all, it looks like this because it's shot by Darius Conchi. And this is, yes, this is a Safdie movie. And yes, it is I have now just forgotten his name. I can't remember people's names. It's a Timothy Chalamet movie. Yes, it's a Timothy Chalamet movie. It's a Timothy Chalamet. No, but like the principles here. But you have to give credit to Darius Conchi, who is the cinematographer, also on Uncut Gems, but going all the way back to City of Lost Children, Seven, you know, a movie I talk about all the time, is one of the best looking sort of pre-digital films, right? It's just glorious. And this movie just looks incredible at every moment, both the way that the lighting works, but also the way the camera moves through spaces. And just watch this movie. If you get it, if you haven't seen it yet, or you go see it a second time, watch this movie for the use of black space and contrast and darkness. It's so pleasurable, especially in the first act when we get to London and we see Marty walking through these darkened ping pong spaces, just these inky, deep black shadows that are sort of like draped across the screen, almost like velvet, right? And it's just gorgeous to look at and to sink into. And then you combine this with this incredible score, which is consists heavily of like 80s new wave synth tracks that gives the movie its kind of futuristic bent, because that's where Marty is going. He is going towards the future, and in fact, in some ways, already living in that future. He has gotten to Tears for Fears before the rest of us, right? Public Image LTD Limited is already in his brain, right? Like that's the soundtrack to his life. And I just, there's a moment early in the first act. So he's gotten to London and he's playing in his one of the early ping pong matches. And I don't even remember exactly what song is going on, but there is a shot. We are watching this happen from the stands, from the crowd, right? It's not one of these close-ups. It's not following and tracking the ball, you know, really closely. You're just sort of watching from afar. And it's so gorgeous and so electric. I had a moment of like, it's like shook me. Like physically, because what in the hell? This is ping pong. It's silly. It's boring. Who cares about ping pong? And this movie shows you 20 minutes in that ping pong is the most beautiful and the most exciting thing in the world, that it is an entire world. And it's Marty's whole world sort of comes out of ping pong. Everything he is doing is in fact to play this game. And it is just as a kind of like on a craft level, as a movie to watch and to listen to, in addition to all of the kind of great fast talking bits, this movie is so pleasurable, like as cinema. When I saw this, I saw it with my wife, who hated it. And she hated it because she found Marty to be so incredibly off-putting and just such a like a deeply bad person that she felt like there's no charm there. There's nothing. There's no appeal in any way. And I've read several reviewers who have said that sort of thing. General reviews have been pretty good. And I just looked at this as, I don't care to some degree. Like, what I care about is that this movie is so exquisitely and gloriously created, from the incredible recreations of 1950s New York to the photography, to just like every bit of this, every inch, every every, you know, dot of pixel of every frame in a digital projection is so perfect and so exquisitely realized that I just sort of sat like, there's a certain point where I just sat back and I was like, I will let this movie take me anywhere. I don't care what happens. I just want to see how.
It's interesting. Hey, I want to highlight something real quick, because you mentioned how good it looks, and there's been some chatter about the cost of this movie. The movie costs $70 million, which frankly is not that much money by modern standards. Yeah. But it's a lot of money for a movie that doesn't involve big action sequences. My only response to that is you see every dollar of it on the screen, because this is a movie that transports you to 1950 or whatever New York, right? This is a movie that uses large crowds. Like, large crowds of extras are not cheap. Those are real people, I'm pretty sure. I mean, there's probably some CGI fill, whatever. But like, those are real
people. I think the people are mostly real. I do suspect that some of the set dressing is digital, certainly when you see kind of extended backgrounds, right? There's at least a couple of shots where you see some like sort of background light, right? Like signs and lights. We know, in fact, just from the reporting, that they redressed a couple of blocks of the Lower East Side of New York for at least several days, if not weeks, to shoot this. That's expensive.
That's not cheap. You see, again, it is not a cheap movie. It's also not that expensive a movie. But for anyone who's like, oh, I can't believe this isn't, look, you know, this isn't spending $200 million on The Irishman or Killers of the Flower Moon, right? Like, it is a relatively cost efficient. You just see it all on the screen. It is money well spent. Because it also just looks great.
Every detail is perfect. I've read some interviews just sort of about the way that this was put together, and it really looks like they just went the extra mile to make sure that everything was period appropriate. And you see this kind of obsession and attention to detail that resembles, I think, more than anyone else, Martin Scorsese. And that's the other thing that I just wanted to raise here, is how much this movie really, even more than Uncut Gems, even more than Good Time, just feels like a kind of, not a ripoff of Martin Scorsese, not just sort of an homage to him, but like Safdie is an actual student of Scorsese, and in particular of After Hours and of the third act of Goodfellas, where everything is going totally crazily wrong, and like Ray Liotta is just absolutely high, and he's like crazy, you know, worried about the helicopters, it's sort of like manically running around town, but it's 2.5 hours of that rather than just the final 40 minutes.
Yeah.
All right.
What did you guys make of the... Can I ask what you guys made of the ending?
Yeah, people have... that seems like people are very divided about the ending and whether it is earned or not. And I found... I think it is. And I mean, when I came out of it, I had this discussion with my wife, who found it totally unearned, because she's like, well, he's a despicable character. Why would we, what in the movie makes us think that he would in any way sort of find something real or sort of like suddenly become a different person? And I think the movie is telling us it's a two-part ending here. One is he scams his way all the way up until that last tennis match, right? Everything is a scam to get to that match, the final showdown in Japan. But he wins the final showdown legitimately based on skill. He didn't fake that, because he really is an incredible ping pong player. And finally, he falls over at the end, he makes that win, and it is, he's got something real, finally, the one thing that is real in his life. And that opens him up to the possibility, to the existence of other real things that are not just sort of lies and stories that you tell to get to the next thing. And of course, the realest of those in the world is a kid.
It's funny, because I've seen the same thing. I've seen people like, oh, I don't buy that ending. It's like, I mean, I don't understand what there is not to buy. I don't like it. There was nothing about that ending that jumped out to me as particularly like weird or controversial, but that's only because we don't go beyond that. Like, we see he's a guy who lives in the moment.
He is a guy who is constantly in the moment and of the moment. And in that moment, he has this new thing, and it changes his I don't know that it even changes his outlook on things. It's just like, oh, cool. I'm very happy about this. And we're going to, I mean, but again, I feel like there's a version of this movie that keeps going after this that, you know, is false. But ending on that moment, I think, is fine, because it's just like, well, it's just another moment in Marty Mauser's life.
Yeah. No, I liked it a lot. That was not a sort of me setting up to say, you know, I think that him just like weeping. And I have to say, however they did the baby's sort of skepticism about him, like, I don't know how they did that. But, like, aces on the skeptical baby who's like, I'm not sure that this person is an appropriate father figure. But I mean, it's both inevitable, right? I mean, the whole, like, the sort of audacity of the opening sequence with, like, you know, a sperm meeting the egg to forever young. But I think, Peter, you are slightly mistiming the moment when he grows up, which is, it's the moment when he realizes that he actually has reached the end of the scam and he is not going to be able to get into the actual tournament. And yes, he beats Ado, who, in an interesting, you know, sort of continuation of the movie's post-World War II theme, became extremely good at ping pong when he was deafened in the sort of firebombing of Tokyo, and has become this sort of, you know, national...
He's the pinball wizard.
Right, he's the pinball wizard, but he's also he's the symbol of Japan's sort of readmission into the international community, right? But Marty realizes that the scam is over. He wins the match and finds sort of redemption on his own terms. He says to Ido, like, I hope you win, right? And he seems, again, it's sort of totally in the moment. It doesn't seem calculated. It's not like into a microphone. And he returns home on an American military transport, mm-hmm. right? Like, Marty Mauser has fought his war and come home. And, like, he has... integrated.
And when he lands, he walks mm-hmm. through this sort of tableau of flags, right? I mean, they're faded into the background, but it is very specifically that he is walking through this patriotic, you know, kind of background. And it's like, this, you're in America now. This is what Americans are, in some sense.
And he is accepting this sort of like universal experience, right? I mean, he has stopped trying to be outstanding in some way and has become sort of part of the American story. I loved that ending with like him swept up in joy, but even his kids sort of seeming incidentally skeptical of him.
But also the story goes on beyond him. I mean, there's a way in which this is a kind of related to the ending of one battle after another, except not annoying.
Yeah, right. And I mean, part of the point of the movie is like, actually, you can only be young for a while. Like, you can't actually be young forever. At some point, you know, if you are at all a functional human being or going to stay alive, you do grow up.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Marty Supreme? Melissa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Thumbs up. One of the better movies of the year.
Sonny? Thumbs up. Good movie. That's what I say. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at Sonny Bunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.